one of the things that got me really excited about curling is, without a shadow of a doubt, we know exactly when lightning is going to strike the clock tower, right? I'm a movie guy. For a lot of your listeners, they may remember the movie Back to the Future, an all-time great. Now, I had never really come across a business opportunity or a sport where you know with an undeniable fact that the whole world is going to fall in love with something in February of 2026. So that's kind of exciting. Curling typically has a massive moment during the Winter Olympics and then it dies. So we have a year or so to maximize that moment to then hopefully continue that momentum to where the sport goes to next.
Hi, welcome to the Growth Mixtape Podcast, and I'm your host, Bob Mathers. We have one rule here. We're going to chase our curiosity way outside our comfort zones. The more uncomfortable and awkward, the better. We're going to talk to people you've never heard of doing jobs you didn't know existed. We're going to hear human stories about the things that connect us, what we can learn from one another, and what we can take away to apply to our own lives. These conversations might not seem to have a lot in common at first, but just like songs on a mixtape, you create something memorable and emotional. Today we talk to Nick Sulski, TV personality, tech entrepreneur, and the guy on a mission to revolutionize the sport of curling. Nick is a character. He went from hosting a kids' TV show to conning his way onto a sports talk show, to pioneering two fantasy sports companies, to his latest challenge, making curling the biggest winter sport in the world. And if you think that sounds a little far-fetched, I'm with you. But when you hear Nick's passion for the game and his plans, you start thinking he could actually pull this off. Nick talks about playing for Canada's national rugby team in the Jewish Olympics, which I had no idea was a thing. He talks about the pain of watching one of his companies implode in a span of 3 weeks, and why he launched the Grand Slam of Karaoke to showcase the amazing athletes he wants to turn into superstars. I guarantee this conversation will change how you think about curling, which, to be honest, is not something I've thought much about at all. But more than that, it's about what's possible when you find the courage to take big swings on what you care about most and giving zero fucks about what anyone has to say about it. Please enjoy Nick Sulski. Hey, Nick.
Hey. Hi, Amy.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. It's been too long.
I know. It's been forever.
Yeah.
I was telling Bob that I ran into Steven in a random elevator, like, 3 years ago.
Random elevator. I know. So weird, eh?
Well, thanks for having me, Amy. I really appreciate it. We've had fun so far, and I love that guitar in the background. Bob, my wife for Christmas got me an electric drum kit, and it's right there.
I think I saw that on Instagram or something.
Yeah.
So there's just so many questions I have about curling and the sport of curling and your plans for it. And I really want to leave most of our time for that. But I want to start first with how you got here, because you've had a really interesting kind of journey through entrepreneurship with fantasy sports and sports betting. And that feels kind of particularly relevant, I think, to this conversation. So first of all, like, how did you get into that light of work?
Oh man, like that's a good question, Bob. And you know, before I got into fantasy and sports betting, I was actually a film and television producer and director and host. I actually hosted my own kids' television show on the Family Channel, I swear. And this was in like 2003, 2004, right around the time there was a very popular sports show called Off the Record on TSN. And they would have, like, you know, Michael Landsberg was the host. And they would have a bunch of like B-level celebrities come on and talk about sports. And I was never a B. I was more of like an E or an F-level celebrity because I was actually on the Family Channel. And I love sports. And as you'll learn and your audience will learn, I don't mind talking. I'm an if you don't ask, don't get kind of guy. So I just emailed the producer of Off the Record at the time. And I had a little fib. I said that I'm on television, I'm on the Family Channel, I played rugby for Canada, and I'd love to come and talk about sports. Now, Amy knows well that at Mount Allison University, I played rugby, and I actually had the great pleasure of representing Canada at the Jewish Olympics, the Maccabee Games in 1997. So I left out the fact that it was the Canadian Jewish team, but I did wear the maple leaf. So I emailed the producer of Off the Record and I said, hey, I'm on TV. I played rugby for Canada. Can I come to your show? And he said, sure. You know, this was right around the time when I started getting very obsessed with fantasy sports, just as a sports fan, as a player. Like, I love fantasy sports. And this was before there was ever any content about fantasy sports on the internet or even on television. And we decided to pitch the execs at TSN about creating the first ever online fantasy sports show. And we used the same crew at Off the Record and we just did it. Didn't cost anything. And that was kind of my entry point into kind of the world of fantasy sports, more on the content side. What I've learned my entire career, but what I learned, especially when I was making content, is you got to be passionate about something. I have to be passionate about something to really kind of get behind it. I think authenticity is so important. People know when you're just trying to sell them shit, you know, but when you actually believe in what you're selling, it means so much more. And so as I was, you know, I'm involved in creating fantasy sports content, I started thinking about the fantasy sports industry and the media landscape and started to kind of dabble in technology. And that was really the entry point into getting into fantasy sports, is trying to create platforms, fantasy sports technology that would help making watching live sports better, which is effectively kind of the whole goal of fantasy, of sports gaming, of whatever is, you know, sports are fun. How do we make that experience of watching sports that much better? And anyway, so that's kind of how I got into fantasy and betting. And well, curling is yet another step in the journey.
So you founded a couple of companies around fantasy and betting?
I did. So I founded a company called InGamer back in the kind of late 2000s. I think it was like 2008, 2009. We got incubated at a company called Mars. Everybody loved the concept. The business model was totally flawed. And so that startup ultimately failed. And as many startup entrepreneurs that you've spoken to, I'm sure have said to you, you learn a lot. You learn more from your failures than you do from your successes. So even though InGamer wasn't necessarily a success, I learned so much about, you know, what a proper business plan and business strategy really needed. You can have a great idea, but if you can't figure out how to monetize it well, you better start talking to some people who can help you figure that out. So that was my first startup. And then I ended up getting kind of recruited into a big international horse racing company that had a number of major relationships with casinos in the United States. And they were trying to figure out how to leverage the boom of a new category called daily fantasy sports. Daily fantasy sports was something in the early 2010s that was starting to really blow up. But the online or the casino operators in North America couldn't touch daily fantasy sports because it was an unregulated form of gambling. So I got involved in that company. But then within about a year, I architected a deal where we acquired Draft Day, and then the goal was to pivot that into becoming a B2B white label platform provider for the online casino companies who couldn't compete against the FanDuels and the DraftKings of the world. And that ultimately worked out fairly well until this is actually a funny, odd story. The deal closed in September 2015. 3 weeks later, there was a scandal in the daily fantasy sports industry, and the New York Attorney General deemed daily fantasy sports illegal sports betting. So here we are. We just acquired this company. I'm all excited. And then literally our business model blows up within 3 weeks. I shit you not. So then it's like, what are we going to do now? And so, I mean, you know, as any entrepreneur would tell you, you got to be able to pivot really quickly when things that are not under your control kind of hit you. So sorry, I'm taking this in odd tangents, Bob. I apologize.
Odd tangents could be the name of this podcast. That's what I enjoy most. That's so interesting. Yeah, the impact that those black swan events, right? Like the New York Attorney General making a decision with one flick of the pen that changes everything about your business, right? It's like COVID. I think about the Fortune 500 companies that probably paid McKinsey $10 million to do a 5-year strategic plan in the summer of 2019, and all of it useless. Not one single PowerPoint slide in that 100-page PowerPoint slide is worth a thing. So it's just amazing. You're right. How quickly you got to pivot and respond to those things.
So yeah, Black Swan events, man, they are the biggest challenges that any startup has to deal with, I think.
Let's bring it back to curling.
Yeah.
What did that those experiences in fantasy and betting kind of, how did that bring you to curling, or what did you learn from that that eventually brought you into the Grand Slam of curling?
Yeah, I mean, again, I think that it boils back down to passion. As anyone that has ever known me, for whatever it's worth, a lot of the adjective that I get a lot from people, you know, is, oh, you're such a passionate guy. Well, that's just the way I'm wired. The thing that I always look for, I'm a builder. I like growth. I like challenges. I remember the first time I walked into a curling event, and it completely changed the perception of what I had, or what I had in my mind about what curling was. You know, I think a lot of people have this perception that, you know, curling is this quiet, antiquated sport played by old, out of shape, white people. And it's just like, okay, that's the perception that, you know, we've had built up over decades. And I walked into my first event and I was like, wow. This, now, candidly, curling is still a sport, predominantly played by white people. And what you'll get from me is, I'm blunt, I'll put all the cards on the table. We want to change that, but you got to start somewhere. But it was young, athletic, unbelievably relatable, fun, smart, funny. I said fun and funny in the same sense, athletes. And, you know, that got me really excited because I just didn't know that existed. So I think that the way that I got here was really just passion and excitement and the challenge of trying to change the perception of what people think of a sport that, let's face it, everyone in the world, or a good number of people in the world, are familiar with the sport of curling. You know, because of the Olympics, curling is one of the most watched Olympic sport, period, across all Winter and Summer Olympics. And so people have heard of the sport, but people have this perception of it. And I was one of those people. So I think what got me here was just my passion, my excitement for trying to change the minds of folks to understand that this is something cooler and bigger and louder than they actually think it is and it can be.
Hey, it's Bob, and I'm taking the Growth Mixtape on the road in a series of keynote speeches inspired by the stories of my amazing guests. At their core, these signature talks are about how to get you and your teams off autopilot and stop settling for small incremental improvements. This isn't going to come from spewing business advice. My podcast is full of people that have done incredible things, and every one of them struggles with self-doubt, imposter syndrome, and the crippling fear of judgment that holds so many of us back. They've also found ways through it by rediscovering their creativity, their curiosity, and the confidence to do scary things. Imagine the power of bringing these vulnerable stories to life, live and on stage, to help you and your teams hit your targets, find your voice, and be the rock stars you are. Book me for your next event at bobmathers.ca. Now back to the show. I would say that's pretty much my perception of curling. I mean, I've been, you know, it's interesting. I've lived in Canada my whole life. It's a huge sport in certain pockets of it. Like, I was in my mid-20s when I worked with a guy from Winnipeg, and he was the first person that I ever met that played curling. But it was my first exposure to the subculture of how passionate people were about it. It was just one of these weird, I was just living in my own bubble, and I would see it on the Olympics and I'd be like, oh yeah. And of course, Olympics, I'm trying to figure out what the hell's going on. There's so much strategy going on. I have no idea what they're talking about, but there's something oddly satisfying about watching, you know, kind of shuffleboard on ice or the amazing things they can do with those rocks. There's something compelling about it. I just don't know anything about it. But when the Olympics is over, it completely leaves my life. I don't think about it again for 4 more years.
Well, and not only do you not know very much about it, but I think most importantly, you don't know anything about those athletes that you've been watching curl. And that's the thing. To me, it's less about bringing attention to the sport. It's more about bringing attention to these curlers, because I think as sports fans, geez, as you know, current engagers with entertainment, it's about celebrity. It's about personality. Like, who gives a shit about watching something if you don't know the characters and the personalities that really make up the fabric of what that is? There's so much content out there these days, right? It's not like when we were growing up, and yes, I'm going to date myself, where, you know, on Saturday night, you watch Hockey Night in Canada because that's the only thing you're going to freaking watch, right? And I grew up in Montreal. So, you know, I'm watching the Montreal Canadiens every Saturday night on Hockey Night in Canada. Now there's so much choice. You need personality. And so I think that's one of the biggest challenges with curling that we're trying to kind of tackle head on, is I think there's one thing about getting people to understand the sport of curling. But to your point, it's like shuffleboard on ice. Really, when you sit back, and what I like about curling, like golf, is I find it quite meditative while I'm watching it, even like baseball. I actually think baseball and curling, there's a lot more synergy there than people want to give it credit for, because you can sit back, you can just relax, you're listening to the announcers, and you can kind of understand what's going on. Now, with curling, you know, it is, like you say, shuffleboard on ice. So to understand the basics of curling isn't that complicated. You know, your goal is to get the rock as close to the middle of the house as possible. And if you do, you get a point. If you have the two closest rocks, you get 2 points. It doesn't take a fucking rocket scientist to figure that out. Where the interesting strategy pieces come in is all of the game dynamics between these teams. You know, throwing the rocks and the sweeping and the communication and all of the angles. Like, you can get pretty deep into it. But from a base level, it's not hard to understand. Pitcher throw ball, batter hit ball. All right, I kind of understand baseball now. Curling is not that complicated. But, you know, the reason why during the Olympics, everybody gets obsessed with it. It's on. You're telling the story of country, which is great. Everyone likes to root for country. But once curling season is over, once the Olympics is over, so one, there's not a lot of curling to engage with, but you've also become synonymous with cheering for Team Canada or Team Sweden or Team Japan. You're not cheering for Chinami Yoshida or Rachel Homan or Anna Hasselborg, right? Now, that's one of the things that I got really excited about in my early days of becoming familiar with the sport, is just how incredibly compelling these athletes are. I got to tell you, I go on social media and Instagram now, and some of the content that some of these curlers are putting out is awesome. Now, our job is to help create a bigger wave of curlers creating even more content. So after the next Olympics in 2026, I hope you, Bob, walk out of the Olympics not only knowing the teams that have done well, but some of these incredible athletes who between now and then we're going to help become stars. So you show up at the Olympics and you're there, you're going to watch Sean White, you're going to watch Mark McMorris. You know, these are names that we've become familiar with, but that's kind of that's the thing that one of the things that's kind of driving us is, you know, we talked about this in one of our first conversations. One of the things that got me really excited about curling is, without a shadow of a doubt, we know exactly when lightning is going to strike the clock tower, right? I'm a movie guy. For a lot of your listeners, they may remember the movie Back to the Future, an all-time great. Now, I had never really come across a business opportunity or a sport where you know with an undeniable fact that the whole world is going to fall in love with something in February of 2026. So that's kind of exciting. So our number one job, our number one job, is to do whatever we can to build up to that moment and then harness and leverage that power to then blast off to the next stage of where this sport can go. Because to your point, curling typically has a massive moment during the Winter Olympics and then it dies. Well, if it's something's going to get here, that's an amazing starting point, right? So we have a year or so to maximize that moment to then hopefully continue that momentum to where the sport goes to next.
Man, there's so much I love about that. And I want to come back to that clock tower analogy. Before we do, I want to circle back to how this kind of maybe connects a little bit with the fantasy world, because you said it really well there. I do think that curling and golf and baseball, they're kind of meditative, they're relaxing. I can kind of have them on in the background. But I don't know that that appeals. It didn't appeal to me until I got a little bit older. And I don't think it appeals to a younger audience. And I watch my kids watch football and they've got multiple screens going. They got Red Zone going. They got fantasy. They're tracking their parlays. Man, it's like a day trader going on. And so I do wonder how you make this sport that's kind of, I think, naturally appeals to people older, appealing to younger people that are just used to action, 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 things going on. Maybe it is that. How do you turn the event into a game like fantasy does?
The first thing you need, and I could not agree with you more, fantasy sports and now sports gambling, but fantasy sports to me forever was a way to get deeper into the game. You learn more about the players, you care more because you're rooting for specific players that may or may not be on your favorite team. Unfortunately, I mean, I was born in Montreal, but I grew up in Southern California. So unfortunately, I'm a diehard Raiders fan. And for any of your listeners who happen to also be Raiders fans, I'm sorry. I'm with you. It's been freaking terrible for like 20 years. But I still love football because I play fantasy. And so there's specific players that I can root for. But to go all the way back to it, There's no gambling, let alone fantasy in curling. But one of the biggest challenges the curling has, and this speaks directly to me because of my experience. This is another one of the reasons why I'm very excited about the growth opportunity of this sport. There's no gambling in curling because there's no live data. So there's no live data, and most importantly, from a gambling operator's perspective, there's no live odds, projections, feeds that can allow a sports betting operator to manage the liability in real time to allow for live betting. So I know that's a little bit kind of inside curling or inside baseball, but at the end of the day, operators want to offer sports betting markets, but operators also want to make money. So operators are not going to offer bets to their consumers unless they know that they have a better than 50-50 chance of winning those wagers, right? The house always wins, but I mean, that's the whole point, right? Curling is a sport. The grand slam of curling, there's eight ends or eight innings, right? There are eight shots for every end. So we're talking about not only, I think it's 124, my math is bad, 128, whatever it is, live betting moments every game that is being completely ignored by the sports betting community, but there isn't even live betting right now during games. And so right now, the few operators that offer sports betting only offer pre-match core markets. And what that means is you can bet before the game begins who you think is going to win, by how much, and what the total amount of points that are going to be scored in that game are. That's it. Once the game begins, you can't gamble anymore, right? That's a significant gate to engagement. It's all about live now, right? So what live data is going to allow us to do, one, is to start getting deeper into the analytics. So from a name a sport right now where the front offices, where the athletes, where the coaches aren't diving into real live analytics to make them better, right? So this live data, and we're working with a third party called Alt Sports Data. They're an amazing company based out of California. They're actually building this new live data platform for us, but also our new odds projections feed that we're going to be able to then deliver to the sports betting operators. So finally, operators are going to be able to offer gambling markets on curling, which to your point is going to significantly improve our appeal to the younger sports fan who not only is more akin to the live, you know, the live engagement, but let's face it, curling events, the grand slam of curling starts on a Tuesday and it goes through Sunday. And a lot of our games are, you know, they start at 8 a.m. and there's four draws a day, four games per draw. And three of those draws are before 7 p.m. Eastern. There are not a lot of other live sports on at 1 p.m. Eastern on a frickin' Wednesday. But curling is. And you know what gamblers like to do more than anything, Bob? Gamble. They like to gamble. And so curling is going to be a sport that is almost always on at times where there is a lack of other sports to engage with. what that does is it provides another way and another reason for the audience to get deeper into who these athletes are and how the game is played. The other challenge we have around engaging a young audience is the perception that going to a curling event is boring, right? And that is about, that's changing, right? One of the things that got me about curling was the fact that, you know, after that very first curling event that I mentioned I went to, as soon as the event ended, I was standing there having a beer, and the other curlers who I just watched on the ice were having a beer in the same bar that I was at. And I was like, wow, this reminds me of rugby. And he goes, like, my whole life goes back to rugby. My whole business philosophy revolves around rugby, but that's another conversation. And so I was like, wow, this is really, really interesting. And so ultimately, another analogy for golf is golf, the perception and the demographic around golf completely changed, in my opinion, because of Phoenix Open, the Waste Management Open that really started blowing up about 5-6 years ago. What that event did was they tried to inject the energy of what it's like to be in the golf community into the golf event itself. Golf used to be one of those events where it was like, shh, everybody got to be quiet. No, oh no, there's a backswing happening. Now you go to a number of golf events and there are holes, there are moments where it's a party, where people are having fun. It's not just about drinking. It's about giving fans the permission to have a good time. Sports are fun. Curling suffers from the exact same thing. And so one of our challenges right now is to try and break that mold of when people come to a curling event, they can cheer, they can yell, they can boo, they can scream, they can do whatever they want. And the curler wants it. The curler loves it. Here's an example. Our last Grand Slam event in Guelph, one of the things that I saw for the first time, and there were these three curlers from the Allure Curling Club. There's another good shout out. And they came dressed up in banana costumes. There's a shot in curling called a peel, right? That's a shot. They came dressed in banana costumes with signs that said peel. Whenever there was a peel, they would stand up and cheer, peel, peel, peel. The crowd was laughing and loving it. The curlers were laughing and loving it. Yes, that is awesome. Not to like break a big story, but let's just say in Toronto, those banana boys are coming back. And we might be adding a number of other costumed individuals to the crowd because that's fun, right? That will help bring the age demographic of curling down on top of all of the content that the curlers are now starting to put out. And sports gambling, which we hope to launch from an MVP perspective in April for the Players' Championship in Toronto.
You mentioned the Waste Management Open, and if you watch that, it's sort of circled on a lot of people's calendars in terms of golf events. But there are a lot of purists. They're like, you can't do this to our sport. Like, what are you doing? And people that are resisting a lot of that change. And I got to believe you've got some of that too. So how do you deal with that?
Well, the first thing is I don't go to Facebook. So I left Facebook, which is where I've learned most of the trolls go. And full shout out to Brad Jacobs, the last Canadian man to win a gold medal at the Olympics. Incredible skip. I get screenshots of him trolling or him chirping some of the Facebook trolls, which is just amazing. So, I mean, you know, in seriousness, yeah, there are a bunch of traditionalists that don't necessarily like some of the changes that kind of butt up against kind of traditionalist views, you know. But the way that I think about it is, candidly, the sport of curling has been broken for a long time, right? There are very few curlers who actually make enough money to not need secondary jobs. And that blew me away when I learned that. And my goal, my number one goal, because if this happens, then everything else, it'll mean that everything else has been a success. I want to see the day when curlers don't need second jobs to put money on their table. I want curlers to be treated, respected, and paid like the professional athletes they are. So what I say, so right now, I believe curling over the last number of years or forever has been somewhat broken. There has not been business models in place. Curling has typically been owned and run by a bunch of international not-for-profit associations whose goals are creating and enhancing the next category of Olympic curlers, right? Which is fine. But that's not business. That's not revenue generation, right? I believe that curling needs an injection of energy. I think curling needs curlers to be stars, which will allow sponsors and brands to be more excited about attaching their own brand identity to this sport. Because at the end of the day, the brands and sponsors, they're thinking long term, and they're also thinking about who they want to associate themselves with. A long-winded answer to the way I usually frame people who don't like what we're doing. My response to them is, so you don't like curlers. That if you love curling the way that you say you love curling, you can't love your sport without loving the curler. The curlers are all supporting what we're doing. The curlers all want to be respected, treated, and paid like other professional athletes. So if you don't like the things that we're doing to enhance the profile of curling, to help build this sport up to a point where curlers don't need second jobs, then you're a hypocrite. At the end of the day, you can't love a sport and not like the athletes who are supporting the changes that we're trying to shepherd into the sport. So I think the traditionalist view, you can still love curling. We're not going to change your sport. We're not going to make it. We're not going to fuck it up, right? But at the end of the day, this is a sport that has had challenges. Still has challenges, right? If we want curling to succeed, if we want curling to get to a big international stage, if we want you, curling fan, to be able to watch more curling by the world's best curlers, guess what? The sport needs more money. And it's not working the way that it's been working. So you know what? You got to break a few eggs to make an omelet, right? I've said that before, and I'll probably keep saying that for a number of years until some of these older curling fans agree with some of the things that we're trying to do. But that's okay, because ultimately I love the curlers and they understand what we're trying to do here.
Sometimes I wonder, do you have to have at least tried to play a sport to appreciate the athleticism involved in it? Like, I wonder when I watch golf, I thought it was the most boring thing in the world, and I still suck at golf. But when I go out there and try to play, now I can watch it on TV and be like, oh my God. And I've only tried to curl once. And I could not believe how much harder it was. And so it's like anything, right? It's like, if all you do is watch people that have dedicated their lives and have millions of hours of practice, of course they make it look easy. Until you try to step on that weird ice with the bubbles and try to push a rock, it's freaking impossible. Like, hopefully the game starts to grow and more curling rinks and more people getting into it at an early age to appreciate what a cool sport it is.
100%. I mean, curling clubs are actually growing significantly, not just in Canada, but all over the world. But the one thing I would say about curling is a really hard sport to play well, but it's not a hard sport just to play. Mm-hmm. But to your point, yeah, we need to figure out creative ways to get people just interested in going and throwing a rock. Because once you go and throw a rock, you're like, oh, okay, I get it now. The thing about curling that we really want to try and find is we want to find that recreational or that casual curling fan who's willing to engage with the sport. And if they go off and they throw a rock, are they going to be more likely to engage? 100%. So how do we do that? So again, that's on the whiteboard.
Well, yeah. So this whiteboard that you've got and all these plans that are building momentum up for the Olympics, what would you say is the source of that creativity? Where does this inspiration come from?
I don't know. Like, I've been a creative guy my entire life. I just love it. You know, I will say I don't shy away from the odd joint or the odd glass of tequila. So, you know, the reality is it's not going to be a surprise to anyone that that intoxicants occasionally help creativity. Like the fantasy sports company that I co-founded, this was the startup that was my hit, right? It was called Monkey Knife Fight. And there's dozens and dozens and dozens of gaming companies out there. We didn't do anything significantly different than everybody else. But we built a brand, right? Like, why not, right? So, I mean, where do ideas come from? That idea came with me and my co-founder over, ironically, some glasses of tequila one night. But at the end of the day, like, I'm not scared to take chances. I like to laugh. I like to try and make other people laugh. I live by a life philosophy. I give zero fucks. Like, I don't care. Like, I don't care what people think about me. I don't care what people, I generally don't care. But yeah, I mean, I think that's a great question. Where does creativity come from? I just think it's just inside, you know, of me personally.
Well, I think it's inside all of us. But what maybe makes you a bit unique is the zero fucks, not being afraid to fail, going out and trying through things. But maybe it's just being, finding that passion.
Well, I mean, and I'll just speak personally, the things that resonate the most with me is when I feel that people are being genuine, when I feel like people are being authentic, and passion comes through.
Yeah, I really love that. I wanted to ask you, we haven't really touched on your journey with cancer. And the thing that I was curious about, because I've talked to a lot of people lately, and I know this for myself, I know this from the conversations I've had, that a lot of times we, and I don't know if this has happened to you, but people kind of live on autopilot. And usually something happens that wakes people up. People don't just go off that autopilot on their own. They usually have a reason to do it, like a cancer diagnosis. It's not obvious to me that that's what happened to you, but I am curious what impact that had on this kind of journey that we've been talking about.
Yeah, no, it's a really good question. And you're right. It wasn't something that kind of knocked me out of autopilot, candidly. I never really had an autopilot. But and I was diagnosed about 16 years ago. When you get hit with cancer and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, which, you know, candidly is not the most, it's not the most aggressive or dangerous type of cancer, but it's something that is incurable technically. So I'll have it forever, right? So, you know, the thing that it taught me, or the thing that it really sparked in me, was the ability to compartmentalize. Like when I first got hit with cancer, it was really hard to stop thinking about it, like for years. And still, because of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, it's you know, lymph node. You know, I feel my lymph nodes 5 times a day. But that's part of just my habit now. But it took me a number of years to be able to shut that fear of cancer, or that thought, the constant thinking about it, out of my head. And so it kind of started at like, okay, it's cancer and it's life, cancer and life. And then it was like cancer and life and work. Okay. So then it was three. So, you know, fast forward to today, I can switch from one thing to another. Focus, deal, switch, focus, deal. So I think that what cancer gave me was the beginning of understanding how to properly leverage compartmentalization to allow me to function in a number of different areas at the same time without, and the reality is, as any startup founder would tell you, yeah, I mean, the amount of time and energy I've been able to spend with my wife and my daughter from time to time has definitely been a challenge. And they've definitely bore a brunt of that, right? And I feel terrible about that. But at the end of the day, you know, this is what communicating families is all about, right? But the ability to flick on and flick off certain things when you have to, I don't think I would ever have gotten there if it wasn't for my cancer diagnosis.
That really resonates with me in terms of the amount of energy that it typically takes to switch from, you know, take off this hat and put on this hat. You know, even from family and work, and then the dozens of different hats you wear under this work umbrella, and they all take energy and they all take time, and the ability to switch between those things would be a superpower that I wish I had.
I mean, I don't have a lot of skills, like candidly. I think the compartmentalization ability is a skill. And the other thing that I like to believe, really my true business skill, because again, I don't do anything all that well. It's what I like to think is I have an ability to break down lines of communication to allow other people to work together, but also to allow other people to do what they need to do. Right? I think that, and I don't know if I did a good job explaining that, but it's really, communication to me is so important. And I go back to the rugby analogy. I mean, the cool thing about rugby as a sport is it never stops. You have rugby union, especially, you have 15 people on the field, and you can only score a try or defend a try if you're all working together as one. Because it's not like football or American football or baseball, or where there's stoppages in play and there's subs and all that kind of stuff. Rugby, you have to work as a team unit. You have to communicate all day long with all of your other teammates, or you're going to lose, right? The story or the video that I always show to people, any team that I've ever built, is I'll show a video of a try, which is a touchdown in rugby, where 15, there's phases, which are like downs in football, but in rugby, the play never stops. So in rugby, there could be a try where there's like 15 phases. The person that scores the try is probably the person that had the least amount of impact on actually scoring that try. But they're the ones that get the glory of putting the ball down in the end zone. No. Team is about all working together, and team is about being open to and willing to communicate with everybody, filling in for holes when they know that there's a hole, asking people for help when they need help. And it takes a lot of time and energy to be able to get people, I shouldn't say time and energy, it takes time to get people who typically have worked within this like corporate world where they got one job and they report to one person. And like, team is a hard thing. And that's why I just love rugby so much as a sport, because you get wired to think and to work with each other a certain way that I think has a lot of positive benefit as they grow, in the workforce and just in life.
I've got to believe too that one of your superpowers might be to find people that that care about something as much as you do, and then to inspire them with that passion that you just ooze with.
Well, I like to try and inspire people, but I just like to inspire people to be willing to take chances, to be willing to make mistakes, to be willing to throw ideas out there, regardless of whether they think they're good or bad, right? I mean, shit, I'll throw down on our company Slack, my favorite. There's a Slack channel called Mixed Ideas. So typically around, 8:30 on a Friday night and a little bit early on a Saturday, that channel's just going, right? But, most of those ideas are terrible, right? But some of them are decent. But people are passionate about a lot of different things. All I want is find people who give a shit, right? Just care. Just want to work together. Who don't mind, putting themselves out there a little bit. Listen, like we started something in curling called the Grand Slam of Karaoke, which is candidly, it's like one of my favorite things ever, because I learned that curlers love karaoke and we need to create curlers into stars. So what better than to put actual curlers in front of a live band and do karaoke in front of fans, right? And honestly, it's starting to blow up a little bit, which is pretty cool. We had over 15,000 people watch our live stream. We'd live streamed it for the first time in Guelph. But the very first Grand Slam of Karaoke, and I can't sing, I went up on stage first and I sang, because ultimately I wanted the other curlers to know that, listen, like, whether you're a good singer or not, who gives a shit? Put yourself out there, have a good time, right? I mean, luckily for me and for the Grand Slam of Curling and now the Grand Slam of Karaoke, man, some of these curlers can belt. There are some incredible singers and rappers, mind you, within the curling world. And so, I think that it's really just inspiring people to just take a chance, have some fun, like maybe just push outside of your comfort zone a little bit, because, hey, you don't have cancer. Anyway, another bad joke, right? Thank you.
That was a good one. I like that one. Yeah, and I was watching some of the Grand Slam of Karaoke clips, and there are a couple things that struck me. One, yeah, there was a shit ton of people there. There were some good singers, but also some not very good singers. And I was like, man, that is awesome. Like, this is not, it's such an authentic and real thing to see pro athletes do. It's not polished. It's not produced. It's just them up there missing every note, having the time of their lives. Yeah. There was just something really beautiful and funny and real about it.
Well, I think curling is at a really exciting point of its trajectory where the athletes are relatable now. They're still.
Yeah.
Right? They're the kind of athlete that you can imagine going to have a beer with. That's one of the things I've loved so much over the last – I mean, I had started getting to know some of the Canadian curlers a number of years ago. But over the last year, I've gotten to know a lot of the curlers internationally. And, God, there are some awesome people. Like, they're just great people. And that's the thing about this sport, that one of the things that really excites me is it's still a sport where the athlete is, they're willing to go in and sign autographs right after an event. They're willing to go out and have a drink in a room full of fans. I think people are going to start really seeing these curlers in a different light. You know, they're not what people think they are, right? And that's what's so exciting to me is when people get to, you know, they start following some curlers on social, they start watching some curling content, they watch the Grand Slam of Karaoke, and they're like, oh man, Rachel Homan is not who I thought she was. Like, oh my God, she's rapping with the US guys to No Diggity? I didn't expect that to happen. Like, honestly, that's the kind of stuff that I think in this day and age is really going to help curling separate itself from some of these other sports.
Yeah, like I already had a bit of a crush on Rachel Homan, like a lot of people do. And then I see her up there rapping and singing. I'm like, God damn, that's amazing. Maybe Nick can introduce me to her someday.
Hey, man, she's amazing. But that's the thing. Like, there's so many talented curlers, and not just because a lot of these curlers also have to have second jobs.
Right.
So there are curlers who are incredible graphic designers. There are curlers who are incredibly successful mortgage brokers. I'm just like, man, like they kind of all run the gamut, right? And I'm just really excited for the day when the best curlers in the world can just be curlers. When you think about providing for your family and building a sustainable life for yourself, most other sports, when the best athletes retire, what do? A lot of them go into work in that sport. They go to the front offices, they go into the media, they go into the kind of the business of that sport. Well, I want to see a day where when a great curler retires, there's opportunity in the sport of curling that they have just grown up with to actually continue a career, but more on the business or the marketing or the operations or the media side of things. That'd be pretty cool too. Because I will say we bought the Grand Slam of Curling and super excited about the future of the Grand Slam of Curling. But if people think the Grand Slam of Curling is the only thing that we're going to own and operate, well, they're fucking wrong. We got big, 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 big plans, big ideas. And yeah, no, I'm just excited to deliver to the curler and the curling fan something bigger than what the sport is today.
Man, you've given me so much to reflect on here, Nick. Like, seriously, I've learned a lot about curling, but talking about your journey, you know, the passion, the purpose, there's just so many. It's a bit of a entrepreneur masterclass and stories and curling and passion all mixed into one. And I'm going to be soaking on this conversation for a long time. I'm really excited to go back and listen to it in a couple of weeks.
Wow. Well, no, I appreciate that, Bob. I mean, honestly, I'm not just saying this, like I've had the great pleasure of doing lots of podcasts, and you know, you've done a lot of homework, but the kinds of questions that you've asked, and I've really enjoyed listening to a bunch of the Growth Mixtape episodes. And what I really love is your ability to get things out of your guests that other hosts candidly just kind of glance over. Like it is about getting into the personal. And I haven't really thought a lot about kind of, you know, things like what cancer has meant to me from a professional perspective, but just in getting your pre-interview questions, it really had me kind of thinking about it, you know? So no, thank you, because I think you also opened up my mind to some of the things that I've experienced in my career, just to look at it in a little bit of a different way. And, you know, thank you for saying masterclass. I would object at that wholeheartedly. I don't know about masterclass. You know, this is like level one or level two shit, but you know, but I appreciate the words.
Well, and I really appreciate you saying those things. Just like you, I'm figuring it out as I go and just trying to chase my curiosity. And this is just, I've got to have to thank Amy for introducing us, producer Amy, but the wizard behind the curtain, because it's just been such an amazing conversation. I've loved every minute of it.
Oh, that's awesome, Bob. Well, feel free to call me after. I got some stories about producer Amy back from.
I need more of those stories in my life.
I'm going to edit that out.
Yes. The Growth Mixtape Podcast with Bob Mathers is produced by Bespoke Projects. Music by Je M'appelle Walter Cronkite. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to follow and rate us. When you do this, it helps to raise our podcast profile so that more people can find us. If you want to connect, you can find me on LinkedIn using the link in the show notes.